The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Good morning, everyone. So, in case you haven't noticed, we are in the holiday season. So it's a time when sentiments of peace and love and joy are freely shared and easily shared, maybe sometimes too easily. When we use anything over and over again, it tends to lose its value. We stop seeing it. We can stop hearing it. Words can lose their potential, in a way, lose their demand, what they demand of us. They can become public property without any personal commitment. A student once wanted to ask Master Yumin a question and started to say, "The light serenely shines over the whole universe." And Yumin interrupted the student and said, "Isn't that the poem of Chang Cho?" Student said, "Yes, it is." And Yunmen said, "You've missed it." And the commentary says, "This student, while their whole body is in the midst of the light, seeks it outside themselves. This is called binding oneself without a rope. Anyone who clings to an old saying and carries it about is creating distance that does not really exist." I've been reading a book by Wendell Berry, who many of you know, maybe some don't. He's a poet, a writer, generational Kentuckian, and sometime activist. And I first read a book of his when I was a teenager. I don't know how I came across it, Unsettling of America. It was about agriculture. I wasn't particularly interested in farming. I'm not sure how I came across it. But it made an impact on me, and I continued to go to his writings over the years and have continued still. So I want to draw some from this book that I've been reading, which is called The Need to Be Whole, Patriotism and the History of Prejudice. And in that, he says, among the necessary and the least dispensable words in our language are those by which we name our values. Here's a list, surely incomplete. Truth, justice, mercy, forgiveness, peace, equality, trust, hospitality, generosity, freedom, love, neighborliness, home, reverence, beauty, care, courtesy, goodness, faith, kindness, health, wholeness, holiness. And he says it's obvious, first of all, how unhappily these words and the thoughts they name must associate with the materialism, the several determinisms, you might think of dogmas, the ideal of mechanical efficiency and the rule of profit in war, which now intrudes so powerfully into their company. And he says, so we need them even more than ever. He said, we need them as abstractions, commonly understood as they appear often in the Bible. He's a Christian, very active practice, a very devoted Christian, and as they appear in the founding documents of the United States and in other classics of literature. He said, we need them, that is, as the names of familiar ideals by which to rectify our thoughts and our lives. But we need them also in the particularity of effort as we practice them, or as we try or fail to practice them. Buddhism certainly has many words that it uses, many of those that he cites, and others, that we draw heavily upon, we use often, and can become casual, can become, in a sense, cheapened. What they point to is never cheapened, is always demanding, but how they sit in our mind. And in the same way that he points to how these qualities, we might call them virtues, can read at odds in samsara. The words that we use in Buddhism, again, many of these that he cited, can seem to be at odds with our delusion. And that's why practice can be so challenging. But the Dharma teachings don't create conflicts. They don't create agitation within us, or anxiety, or fear, or distance. All of those are already present. What they do is they just bring them out. Or they bring out the lack of them, the absence of them, or the way in which they exist in a diminished state. And so then they challenge us. These words, these teachings, these qualities, these virtues. And they challenge us within ourselves, but also between ourselves. Between our friends and family, they challenge us between ourselves and our society, between anything that we relate to, our prevailing beliefs, our narratives. And they're constantly challenging us to determine what is true and what is not true, what is skillful and what is not skillful, what leads to wisdom and what generates delusion, what strengthens our compassion and what shuts it down. He said, we need these more than ever now. And so how important are these words and the meaning they convey? Well, one way I think about that is, how is it when those are lacking? Not only what they point to, which is most important, but even the words themselves, when the words themselves start to fall out of common usage, of our everyday languaging, our vernacular, they find themselves less and less coming into our conversations or the words of the experts. How is it when there's an absence or lack of truth or justice or mercy or forgiveness or trust, neighborliness? That can help to make it very clear how important these words and what they point to are. Because to the degree that they're diminished, our lives actually become diminished. Actually, our lives begin to be put into jeopardy. And so he says, we need them as abstractions, which can sound kind of strange at the beginning, particularly as practitioners, right? Because we're so often trying to bring things out of abstraction and into their reality, what they are. But he says, we need them as abstractions in the sense of, what do they mean? Right? Because that's the function of these words, is to carry a meaning, right, that we can understand, relate to, put into practice somehow. He says, so we need them as abstractions as they're commonly understood, so that we can also understand them together. Because they're not going to be of much use if I'm the only one who understands them, or you're the only one who understands them, but nobody else does. So that we can rectify our thoughts and our lives, put them right. What these words point to, help us to put our lives right. And when they're not active within us, they're not part of our vocabulary, active, then our lives are less and less right. And, you know, I think most of us, we hear most, if not all, of these words growing up. Hopefully they're sort of being taught to us as qualities and values that we should value and put into practice and that expected to live, try to live, even if moments we fail, and that when we don't, hopefully we were held accountable by our elders, our parents, our friends, or even more importantly, ourselves. Because ultimately, we each have to live with ourselves. That's the deal, right? We have to live with ourselves. And the Buddha understood this in the most profound way. And that when we're not living with ourselves, can't, won't, that just is not going to go well. It's not going to go well for ourselves, but it's not going to go for anybody around, well, anybody around us either. In Dharma practice is this. We encounter language. Part of our practice is to study, to understand, what do these words mean? Not what do I think they mean? Well, my sense of it is, you know, sometimes a student will bring up a very important concept and say, well, the way I feel about that is. Well, it's fine to have a feeling about something, but let that feeling be connected as a practitioner to what the Dharma is actually saying, meaning. Why is it employing that word? What does it mean? Not just how do I feel about it, but what does it mean in terms of how I'm living, how I'm practicing? And so we apply them. And since we apply these words actively into our body and mind through practice, that's why we sit before a talk. And so whatever the words that the teacher is offering is being received by all of us, including the teacher, within a body and mind that has been prepared to receive it, so that we can finally stand in accord with the real nature of things, which means that we, along the way, to truly do that means that we have to understand that the words, the principles they represent, the ideas, are all empty of anything intrinsic, of anything inherent, so that we don't attach to them. In the Lankavatara Sutra, it says, a bodhisattva is said to have grasped true meaning well when, alone in a solitary place, they walk the path leading to nirvana by means of their transcendental wisdom, which comes forth from studying, reflecting, meditating, and causing an awakening at the source of their habit energy, revealing their true wisdom. Then they can abide within the successive stages of realization, and they can lead a life full of excellent actions. And so this morning we sit and go into a solitary place, walking this path, turning towards, beginning to encounter, developing, studying, meditating within, awakening our transcendental wisdom. But Windelberry goes on to say, but we also need them in their particularity of effort as we practice them or as we try to practice them, and will sometimes fail. Then he goes on to say that words on his list, probably none are more prominent in usage publicly than equality and justice. Like all the others, these can become too public, can reside for too long in public speech and public places without being brought home to the toil and the testing they will meet in our households, our neighborhoods, and communities. He says he finds within himself an impulse to trust that all humans in the Declaration of Independence, right, have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But, and then not to resist it exactly, but to counter it with what I know he knows of particular people. So countering all people, all sentient beings, with what we know of actual people, sentient beings. He says, without a sustained movement of conversation back and forth between the public and the personal, the general and the particular, then equality and justice can decline towards nonsense. Like the other words that belong, so to speak, to their family of meanings. Particulars are measured and oriented by generalizations. Generalizations are enlivened and tested by particulars. Among the other things it does, knowledge of particular persons sets a cleansing fire to prejudices and stereotypes, which can grow like weeds among our ideals and principles, so that we may see through them to actual human faces. The toil and the testing is what we call mountain training, ascending and descending. and without a sustained movement back and forth. So we sit, and then we walk, and then we sit, and then we go downstairs and have lunch. We do a session, session precautions, and then sessions ends, and we return to our normal day. We turn inward, and then we turn outward. We practice silence, and then we speak. We're in stillness, and then we act. We go to that solitary place, and then we enter into the realm of others. Without a sustained movement, back and forth, public and personal, our, not only our speaking, but what we can do can decline towards nonsense, which means it just is losing its power, its purpose, its potential, its demand. It ceases to be meaningful and honest. I think of the Buddhist teaching of idle talk. And so I was thinking of the personal, the relative, is to study the self, as Dogen speaks of it, and the public, the universal, is to forget the self, and to unify those, to be enlightened by the 10,000 things, to liberate the bodies and minds of self and other. And as he says, the particular sets a cleansing fire to prejudice and stereotypes which grow like weeds. Our ideas, our views, particularly the ones that are, well, they're all, if we hold on to them, they're all based in our sense of ourselves, our identity. And the danger, of course, is that we can appear sincere in our raising bodhicitta, making vows to alleviate suffering, but never actually raise a hand to help anybody. And we can believe deeply in our commitment to the bodhisattva path until we run into somebody else who's different. The personal of self and the public, or the personal of another. And so the false boundaries that we create, right, which are the sort of the part of the essential mechanics of prejudice and bias in all forms of not seeing one another, the segregations, right, of race, gender, sexuality, class, education. You know, we seem to have few limits in terms of how we can categorize other people. Urban and rural, liberal and conservative. And of course, that makes a false idea of the personal, a person, a living being. And it creates something that seems universal. And so a whole group of people become, take on certain intrinsic qualities and characteristics, which means we haven't seen them, we've never seen them, but now we don't have to. Because we know them. I know you. I don't have to know anything about you. I don't have to see your face. And so our Zazen practice, Zazen Dharma practice, is to see into the falseness, to meet the true person, the true reality, so that we can actually meet those differences. Which brings up the question is, what is equality, right? What is sameness within the differences? What is the absolute within the relative? These very essential teachings, particularly in the Zen tradition. Wendell Berry says, when we carry this principle home among our familiar and our neighbors, families and neighbors, where ordinarily and fortunately we are beyond the law, we are immediately confronted with a multiplicity of inequalities, intelligence, appearance, health, age, strength, education, wealth, talent, fate or fortune, and so on. And so we realize that to treat all persons as though they're actually equal, ignoring their differences, is at best inconsiderate. At worst, it's foolishness or even cruelty. Because people individually are not equal to one another, we need discernment. We need patience. We need good manners. Good manners. Ways of enacting respect or courtesy or kindness or compassion for those we perceive as better off or worse off. Our neighbors are not effectively our equals unless we treat them as equally entitled to our regard in spite of the inevitable differences. sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. And that's a vow that we then are to commit to bringing into today. This one, this one, this one, this one, this one. May all beings be free of suffering and know the root of their suffering. So to hold a person in mind, to see their face, or a group of people that I want to extend that metta to, and see them, hold them in my mind's eye. So they're not abstractions, they're people. To meditate on death, for instance, is in a sense to meditate on something very public, very universal. But when I meditate on my death, it's very personal. When I meditate on the death of somebody I love, it's very personal. It's merging the two. He says, the news has obliged us to imagine a public demonstration in which the self-denominated side of love has confronted the side of hate, believing that a victory of love over hate will secure equality and justice to people who have been oppressed because, for instance, of their race. He said, I recommend second thoughts about the possibility of a side of love. Let's have second thoughts about that. But current political rhetoric tends towards such an absolute division. The side of hate is composed of avowed racists. Avowed racists have espoused an absolute, unaccepting prejudice against a kind of people. And so they may be called the side of hate, rightly enough. That haters hate is morally as straightforward and as uncomplicated as it can be within the world of hatred. But they themselves are perceived by the side of love, those on the side of love, as a kind of people. And the side of love, as perceived by the side of hate, is a kind of people also, another kind. And so we have a confrontation of two opposite kinds of people, lovers and haters. Each side is absolute in its identity as it can make itself, and they do not know each other. They cannot imagine each other. Or maybe cannot imagine each other differently, more, larger, more complex. I think of the koan where Zhao Zhao goes to the two hermits and says, are you in? And one raises their fist. And Zhao Zhao says, shallow. Another hermit raises their fist exactly the same. And Zhao Zhao says, deep. Fayan points to the blinds. Two students go over and roll them up. Fayan says, one has it, one has not. These teachers create one side and then the other side. And you know which side you want to be on already. Everybody knows. Nobody wants to be on the side of the one who doesn't have it or the one who's shallow. What are we to do? Deluded and enlightened, lay and monastic. As soon as the boundaries are mistaken for real, then the seeds of lovers and haters is present, just waiting, just waiting. In the Mountains and Rivers Sutra, Dogen said, the stone woman gives birth to a child in the night. The public becomes personal. This means that the time when the stone woman gives birth to a child is the night. Among stones, there are male stones, female stones, and stones neither male nor female. These stones give support to heaven and to earth. They're heavenly and earthly stones. And although this is said in the secular world, it's rarely understood. We should understand the true nature of birth, that at the time of birth are both parent and child transformed. We must study and fully understand not only that birth is actualized in the child becoming the parent, but that the practice and verification of the phenomenon of birth occurs when the parent becomes the child. Of course, Wendell Berry, I mean, I don't know, actually, maybe he's a practicing Buddhist, maybe he's an enlightened being. But what he's speaking about, we can understand within the ordinary world that we live in, within the ordinary understanding of language. And we can also understand it in the most profound way, a Buddha Dharma. Because it's pointing to something that is fundamental. And when something is fundamental, it's just another way of saying it's essential. Right? In other words, we live without it at our peril. And that's why there's so much emphasis in the teachings on non-duality. I'm not getting caught in one side or the other, not misunderstanding, not deluding one side or the other, but ultimately realizing their unity. That's why in the Zen tradition, there's very specific and very, I would say, sophisticated teachings even on the relationship between what he's calling the public and the personal, the universal and the relative. He goes on to say, because the confrontation is between two categories of people who do not know each other, it will be easy for the side of love first to understand love merely as opposite and opposed to hate, and then to generalize this opposition as an allegorical battle of love versus hate. And so then we exchange slogan for slogan, gesture for gesture, shout for shout. And of course, we can do this in our practice. I would dare say we do this in our practice. And that's not much of a dare. Right? Why would we even imagine that coming into the path, living in, propagating, believing in the absolute sides of things, that would stop? And so we come in on the side of delusion with a commitment to crossing over to the side of enlightenment. Isn't that what the teachings even say? Gate, gate, paragate, hurry, hurry, cross over to the other shore. He says, but then if nature and the rule of battle, which in a way is just what we've done before, go unchecked, the side of love begins to hate the side of hate, and then the lovers are defeated, for they have defeated themselves. If the battle goes unchecked, if it becomes a battle, then the side of hate, love, begins to hate the side of hate. The side of hate may already hate the side of love. But when the lovers are defeated because they have become the haters, then they have defeated themselves. And then he goes on to talk about how love is, the word is reduced to be a popular love. It's like, you go, oh, I love that. I love that, you know. It's sort of like how feeling, you know, the way I feel about something. Right? We would be talking about something that is most profound and say, well, the way I feel about it. So one of the things I have always appreciated about Wendell Berry is he seems to understand the importance of language, how important it is, and so he's very careful. He's also got a great sense of humor, but he's careful. I can tell that when he's writing, he's been very thoughtful about what he says, because he understands the power of language, which means he wants to be very clear on what he actually wants to communicate, and that his communication is as close to that as he can get. That should not sound like something new for us as practitioners. So he goes on to say, but love comes into our civilization, the Gospels being the source best known to him, as a way of being in the world. It is a force extraordinarily demanding and humbling and dangerous too for those who attempt to take it seriously. The actual truth of love, he says, is a force extraordinarily demanding and humbling and even dangerous for those who attempt to take it seriously. And that's one of the, you know, In a sense, when we talk about the light of keeping the lamp, the light of the Dharma alive, we often talk about that in terms of the Dharma itself. And another way of looking at that is that we actually take it seriously, not in a heavy-handed, funereal, somber kind of way, but that it's important, it's essential, it's fundamental, which means we can take then ourselves seriously as a practitioner. And then that becomes an extraordinary force that is demanding. That's part of the deal, to demand, in a sense, of the Dharma, which means to demand of ourselves. And it's dangerous because we are threatening the house that we have built to the degree that we take it seriously. And then he says, as a force and a way of being, love is never satisfied with partiality, with half-heartedness. Love itself is not satisfied with that. It is compelled by its own nature and logic to be always trying to make itself whole. And I think the evidence of that is when we feel it whole, you know that. Something is complete, something is present that is good and deep and essential. When we feel that in terms of the Dharma practice, and it doesn't mean everything has to be going well. That love or wisdom or compassion or aspiration, these words that we use, faith, generosity, they're all trying to make themselves whole, which means they're vehicles by which we make them whole. And when they're whole, we are whole. He says, that's why the Sermon on the Mount tells us to love our enemies. That is an unconditional statement. It's like, it makes me think of when the Buddha would say something, point to some aspect of samsara and say, this is not a path in which there will ever be success. Or Dogen says, study this deeply, and then study it still more. These teachers are trying to communicate something in that moment. It's an unconditional statement. It does not tell us to fight our enemies in order to improve them or convert them by our love. It's just saying to love them. That's the love of the Bodhisattva. And so, because it is personal, to take that public, that universal, that ultimate love, then into the personal, is to also try and alleviate suffering. But the love itself is already complete. It's whole. It's not conditional upon the alleviation of the suffering. And that's the demanding nature. That's why it's demanding. And then he says, in practice, this commandment seems to cancel or delete enemy as a category of thought. And I think that any of us who reflect carefully, deeply, and honestly, and with the intention to make this real, we have to get to a point, at some point, where we realize that we have to seriously reckon with ourselves. Because it can begin with, you know, trying to deal with the haters. But in trying to do that in a serious way, through love, compassion, through wisdom, through the perfections, we have to get to a point where we realize, oh, what this actually means, if I'm serious about it, is I have to reckon with this one. And that may actually even be more important than reckoning with my enemies. Indeed, once that reckoning begins, we may find that enemy begins to take up a different place in our mind. It may cease to become a category of thought. It may cease to be a word that we're actively using because we're no longer actively feeling or experiencing that. And that doesn't mean that people who are creating a lot of harm in the world don't need to be reckoned with. It's not a recipe for passivity. Chinese master Dezhang said, when the transgression or the enemy is transformed into the host, the self, it's not the same. That's what's so radical, I think, about the Buddha Dharma, particularly in times of great need, because the need seems so great and the consequences so real and present. And they are. And to be on a path that you know, it's interesting, the whole idea of taking seriously can so easily be, you know, just more self-clinging, more ego. And it's not that. It's just the importance of life, the importance of a human life, of having this life as a time of possibility, of potential, because you can't not have influence. You just can't. And so then what is it? What is the influence we have, we are creating? And so to take that seriously, and then to do that joyfully, right? The practice of letting go, of realizing selflessness, is what allows us to travel lightly on a path of profound importance. And to take our practice seriously while we take ourselves, hold ourselves lightly, easily. And when we see how easy it is, how repeatedly we fall in to the side of this one or that one, right? It just seems to happen. The habit is so deep. Then we understand why it's so easy for these sides to form and to be formed. Why anyone with a microphone and a loud voice can tap into that with the slightest bit of skill. And sometimes the skill, it doesn't have to be skillful, it's just, I have a lot of money, so listen to me. Or I am in a certain position, so listen to me. And we listen, as though what they're saying is true or helpful or important. And so to actually examine thought, speech, and action, the Buddha understood how powerful we are, how many heavens we can create and how many hells we create. And so, you know, to be a practitioner is to decide to, in selflessness, on a practice of selflessness, is to take charge of our lives. Right? And actually be discerning. Be careful to think critically, to be aware of what we do and their implications. Not in a heavy-handed, you know, overly, you know, neurotic way. Or even a little neurotic way. Well, you're a little neurosis, that's fine. Has to be room for that. So, happy holidays.
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.